This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest once again today is Rick McIntyre, the wolf researcher in Yellowstone National Park. No one spent more time observing and documenting wild wolves than retired National Park Ranger Rick McIntyre. He's watched wolves in America's national parks for more than 40 years and observed over 100,000 sightings. He's the author of the ongoing Alpha Wolves of Yellowstone series, which includes his latest book, The Alpha Female Wolf. And he's currently working on a fifth book entitled Thinking Like a Wolf, which is due out in October. He lives in Silver Gate, Montana, just outside of the northeast entrance to the park.
So welcome, Rick. It's good to be talking with you again. We talked last week, and we get to talk about the flooding in Yellowstone in June of 2022. So did the flooding affect the wolf packs in Yellowstone?
Well, that's an intriguing question. I think what I'm going to say is not that we could see. Wolves are very good swimmers, so I don't think it really had an impact on them. However, you may know that it certainly had a huge impact on park visitation. So I live in Silver Gate, and I was out that morning. I believe it was June 12th, if I remember right. And it had been kind of drizzling and light rain for several days. In all my years here, nothing really seemed special about that. Mm-hmm. And boy, I'll never forget that afternoon I was back in my cabin, actually sitting where I am right now, working on my computer, meaning my back was to the front of my cabin, the picture window. And I just got up and stretched, and just for something to do, I walked to my living room and looked out the window, and I saw water flooding through my front yard like a river.
Yeah.
And I was totally surprised by that. I had no expectation of that. And my initial thought was that years earlier I had seen something like that, and it turned out that beaver had plugged a local culvert, and that caused what I'll say was the first flood. So, naive as I was, I got my hip boots on, and I got ready to leave the cabin to walk over to the culvert to pull out the beaver sticks, and then I kind of realized that this is much bigger than I think something that the beavers could be doing. So, yeah, what was happening was Soda Butte Creek runs very close to my cabin, and so part of it overflowed. Fortunately, in my particular spot, the water kept on flowing away so that my cabin was not damaged at all. It didn't get above the cinder block foundation, so I was extremely lucky about that. I did have time to drive my car to a higher spot, and that survived it without any damage either. But the road that I take out into the park from Silvergate toward Lamar Valley was washed out in three places, real seriously. And so we were stuck here. There was also damage to the road between Mammoth Hot Springs at park headquarters and Gardner. That road was wiped out completely. Initially, the park was closed to everyone, and then they were able to open the east entrance, the west entrance, and the south entrance. And so a couple of times I left Silvergate and had to drive all the way around to Cody and then to the east entrance to get into the park. It was a nightmare. And finally, I just had to, for part of the summer, move to Gardner and operate out of there. And then wasn't able to get back to my cabin until October.
So you weren't able to do wolf observations during that period?
Yes. I worked part-time as a guide for one of the guiding companies in Gardner, and so eventually everything worked out. And you may know that summer they were working on paving and improving what's called the Old Gardner Road, a dirt road between Gardner and Mammoth. So that was eventually paved, and of course it's been open for quite a long time now to the public.
Right.
It's a good quality road. And we're not privy to what the Park Service plans are for the what had been the road through Gardner Canyon. I guess that's still up in the air. That's going to be a massive project if they're going to try to repair that or maybe even have a new route. I think they're trying to figure that out. As far as I know, nothing has been officially decided. But for now, Yellowstone is open normal. It's just that the details are a little bit different.
So when you got back to making observations, were you able to detect any differences in wolf pack behavior?
No, and that is an intriguing question. I think I mentioned that wolves are good swimmers.
Yep.
So for them, especially the older wolves, I think this was, you know, to them just kind of more rain than usual. The rivers were higher than usual. It reminds me that, let me think which year this was. I guess it was actually just before the flood. Yeah, that's correct. That we had a situation with the main pack that I studied, the Junction Butte pack, where we saw a mother wolf pick up a pup in her mouth and then swim first across Soda Butte Creek and then later swim with the pup across the Lamar River.
Ooh.
And in those cases, what they do is, as the mother wolf is dog paddling, if you can visualize that, she holds her mouth up high above the water to keep the pup from drowning.
Yeah.
It was really a fascinating thing to watch.
Mm.
And the pups, they're real little when they do that. And the pups, I guess, just by instinct know that once they're firmly grasped by the mother, that they just kind of go limp. What to me is funny to watch sometimes, for a male wolf, the father wolf or another big male, if a pup strays too far from the den and the male tries to help out by picking it up and, I guess, planning to bring it back, I think they're afraid of their own strength, the big males. And so the mother wolf knows exactly how much force and pressure to use to hold the pup in place. And when you have that right pressure, as I say, the pup goes limp. But if the male is worried about harming the pup, then he's not really holding it with enough pressure.
Mm.
And then I think maybe the pup feels that this is a game or play and will squirm out and drop out. And the male will now be even more afraid when it picks it up. And
yep.
So he ends up being just totally helpless. So the mother has to run over and push him aside and show him how to do it the right way. It can be pretty funny.
When there's a heavy rain coming down, do the wolves just stand out and absorb the rain, or how do they deal with a heavy rain? Do they find shelter somewhere?
No, you know, they don't really seem to be bothered by it. I guess their coats are thick enough that it probably doesn't really penetrate them. I'm trying to remember if I have recollections of pups running into the den. It's kind of hard to say specifically because during the first, I don't know, maybe 4 weeks or so, they're going in and out of the den all the time. But I guess if the pup was scared by heavy rain, if there was thunder, then it would only take a few moments for it to run into the den and have shelter. And then I guess another thing is oftentimes there are, alternate dens in the area, not just one. So wherever a pup happens to be in the general area, there's probably going to be a den entrant way, way less than 30 seconds away.
But don't the dens get flooded out?
That doesn't seem to happen as far as I know. So the entrance might be, maybe 10 to 12 inches across. Generally, it would be on a slope. So I guess maybe a little bit of water comes in, but let's say maybe a savvy mother could have a little bit of an incline once you get into the den, so that if there was a little bit of pooling in the water, that would be more toward the entrance, not toward the back. I myself have not crawled into a wolf den, but when I talk to researchers that have, let's say when the wolves are long gone, there would be a very narrow tunnel going into it that would be just wide enough for an adult wolf to squeeze through. Mm-hmm. And at the very back, there'd be an enlarged chamber, let's say maybe roughly the size of the trunk of an average car. And that's where she would give birth and where she would nurse the pups. So as long as there's a bit of an incline to that, I think it would probably stay dry.
When they were doing repair on the Lamar Road, did that affect the movements of the wolves at all, or the presence?
Well, we were worried about that because they notified everyone that they were going to have to do some blasting.
Uh-huh.
In Lamar Canyon, which is somewhat near the Junction View Den, they had to, I don't know what the engineering term is, to use dynamite to blow up some rock outcrops because they needed to move the road further north away from the river.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it was, everyone was notified that there would be some blasting. Now, what happened was that the wolves did leave their den somewhat early, and we didn't actually, I don't think we saw them in the process of leaving that year, but yes, they did leave. And but they moved the pups to what we call a rendezvous site that actually wasn't that far from the blasting. So I don't know that I can say that the sound of it maybe changed what they were going to do anyway. The theory that I have with wolves is they're smart enough that if something new is happening, particularly your sound, like let's say when young wolves hear thunder, they gradually realize, well, when we hear that, nothing bad happens to it, so I guess it's okay. So maybe blasting would be the same thing, or you know, the sound of a car horn or something like that, a jet plane going over, that they seem to be able to adjust to it in kind of an irrational way.
Earlier you mentioned wolves getting mange. What does it do to a wolf to have it, and how widespread is it? And does their color have some effect on it?
Well, it's a really, really terrible thing when it happens to wolves. And to preface me dealing with the subject, let me give you a little bit of background, which is a really terrible, terrible part of history. I did a lot of research on the past history of wolves in the western states. And here in Montana, it was in the very early 1900s. At that time, maybe there still is, there was a state veterinarian. And the Montana legislature passed a bill, apparently was signed by the governor at the time, that required the state veterinarian to go throughout Montana and in different places capture wild wolves, capture them alive. They would, let's just say they capture wolf A, and they bring that to a compound, to a fenced-off area, where other wild wolves have already been put in there that have been documented to have bad cases of mange. So they put the healthy mange-free wolf in there until they can verify that the new wolf has caught mange. You may know it's caused by mites that burrow into the skin, and it's the actual itching of that that causes the fur loss. So it's a terrible thing. I mean, just imagine a person having bugs under your skin that are driving you crazy, and you're scratching all the time. So when the new wolf was certified to have contracted the mites and had a case of mange, then they would take them out, that wolf out of the pen, take them back to where they had been captured, turn it loose so it would go back to its family with the intent of the program, so that then that wolf would unintentionally infect its family with the mange mites. That's how they were trying to kill off wolves back in the early 1900s. Of course, that program is long, long gone for more than 100 years. But let's just say there's a coyote that has mange. One wolf catches it, goes back to its family, and then it spreads. Some wolves have more resistance than others. It's a terrible thing to see, particularly in the winter, if a wolf has lost most of his fur. It's just a terrible, terrible thing to witness. We partnered with the what's the facility in West Yellowstone, the Grizzly Discovery Center?
Oh, yeah.
Some of our researchers worked out an understanding with them where for to understand how mange affects wolves. They got permission with from them where with some of their healthy wolves to shave a very, very small patch of skin off, like maybe less than a square inch. And then when there was cold weather with infrared photography, they would take photographs of the wolves with a full coat and then the ones that had a little bit of missing fur to duplicate what would happen with mange. And if you're familiar with infrared photography, visualize, let's say, the shape of a wolf with a super bright red spot, a tiny red spot, which, of course, would be that shaved spot. So it would essentially be the equivalent of a human being out in the winter in Yellowstone with a hole in their clothing that exposed them directly to the bad weather.
Mm.
That is just a tough thing to deal with.
Yeah.
We find that some wolves have more of a resistance than others, and it just comes and goes. Where we're a little bit worried now because we are seeing wolves, some wolves scratching quite a bit, maybe more than average. I myself haven't seen any obvious cases, but I'm a little bit concerned right now.
What percentage of pups die of distemper?
I have to say I don't know. It is pretty high when we get them. What I can say is, and I mentioned that we've discovered that wolves with black fur, yes, wolves with black fur have a resistance to distemper. So 1 year, the Junction Butte Pack had a lot of pups. I forget the exact number. And by the end of the distemper period, the only surviving pups were all black, all the gray pups that died. We think that maybe thousands and thousands of years ago, a wolf, and it might have actually been a dog now that I'm thinking of it, in the Yukon, maybe 10, 12,000 years ago, in a native village, was born with a mutation that caused its fur to be black. Apparently, the DNA people tell us that prior to that, all wolves and all dogs were gray. There were no black canines.
Mm.
And this one was born with a mutation, and somehow that mutation causing the black fur also, in an unknown way, gave that particular wolf some degree to fight off distemper. And I guess back then, if you had a sled dog, there were no chains. And so I've heard that Native people then kind of encouraged their sled dogs to mate with wild wolves to strengthen the breed. And in the end, then, at least in Yellowstone, about half of our wolves are black, and they do have a much better resistance to it thanks to that event 12,000 years ago, according to the DNA people.
Mm-hmm. So your recent book, The Alpha Female Wolf, how did you structure that, and what's the story that it tells?
Well, there's so much to say about the 06 female. I've known so many female wolves over my life, and boy, she really stands out in so many ways. To start off, I'll say that she was the equivalent of a Disney princess, and that she was just drop-dead gorgeous. And when she grew up, she was just courted by all the male wolves. They just kind of lined up to win her a favor.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very self-sufficient. And she just rejected these males left and right, couldn't care less. But if one took her fancy, then she would hang out and there'd be a bit of a romance there. But boy, yeah, if any of them got a little bit too forward with her, she would just destroy them.
Mm.
And they wouldn't even fight back. They were so afraid of her.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I always think there's a song by the band Heart where the woman singer is saying to the no-good boyfriend, if looks could kill, you'd be lying on the floor saying, please, baby, please, don't hurt me no more. And that was pretty much the story of the 06 female. They were afraid of her. And I think, did we earlier talk about how she picked the two young brothers?
Yeah, we talked about that last time.
Yeah. And so, you know, that was a good example that it's all up to the female. Well, I guess as it is with human relationships, too. She was courted by all sorts of guys, and she just waited till in her case, the right two brothers came along. So it was definitely her choice, not the males. And I, in a way, I like to specialize in watching the mating behavior of wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And after 06 died, one of those brothers, who by that time was getting pretty old, he was known as Wolf 755. To me and to everyone else, there really wasn't much about his appearance that was anything special. He was an average size. He had a black coat that was turning gray. We knew that apparently there was something special about him because of him being picked by 06. But what I'm leading up to, after 06 died and he was a widower, I saw him just walking along once by himself in the mating season, which is in February, and the alpha female from a neighboring pack saw him at a distance.
Uh-huh.
And ran away from her family, ran over to him, and I'm not sure how I should put this, but let's just say indicated that she very, very much wanted to be bred by him.
Yeah.
And he was very willing, and they were just about to do the act, where a huge male from her pack, much, much bigger than 755, saw what was going on, and ran over and, let's just say, interfered in what was about to happen. And 755 didn't quite have the strength to challenge the guy, so he had to kind of leave that.
Yeah.
But 755 was this example that we've talked about social skills, I think, in our previous conversation. Later, when he was even older, he walked into a rival pack and somehow formed a friendship with the alpha male, who was much younger, much bigger, much stronger than he was. And the end result of that was that he was later seen breeding the alpha male. The last time 755 was seen, the following spring, there were a whole group of pups that were following him that presumably he had sired that winter, you know, despite the fact that he was a newcomer in the family. So I'm just fascinated by, let's say, that parallel to wolf behavior in human family, how some individuals, male or female, they just know the knack of how to fit in. And whether you want to say making friends or having good social skills, I'm not sure how to explain it, but boy, he was the world champion at that.
Well, Rick, we're almost running out of time again, but I want to ask you about the book you're working on right now, Thinking Like a Wolf. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, thanks. It's going to come out next fall, and it's a little bit different because in my previous books there was one main character. This one has four main characters, and it just happens to be two sets of fathers and sons. And boy, we could talk for a long time about it, but maybe what I'll do is to say that I'm especially interested in the issue of resilience in wolves. And one of the main characters, a female 926, actually she's the daughter of 755, he's one of the main characters. She had such tough luck during her lifetime. Her mother was the 06 female, and her mother died when she was very young. Her father left her to find a new mate. And when she got older, 3 years in a row, all of her pups died through no fault of her own.
That's it.
And you know, what could be worse for a mother wolf 3 years in a row to lose all of her pups? But she just kept on moving forward. She bred again for the following year, and she finally had a good year for pup survival. So she just refused to give up. She just kept on moving forward. just like her father did. So that's the theme of resiliency. The other theme that I was interested in is what I call life strategies. And I'll just very briefly go over that, and then maybe we can have a discussion at some other time if you'd like to get into more details.
Sure.
So one life strategy within the structure of a wolf pack is what I call being a rebel, and that would be actually challenging the alpha in your gender, whether it's male or female. You challenge and fight the alpha, you win, now you're the alpha. It's like to be the king, you have to defeat the king, or to be the champion, you have to defeat the champion. And then another of the four life strategies, we've already talked to this, to disperse. You just leave home, find a mate, and then start your own family. So you're an alpha based on that. And then a third one is what I call a bider. You bide your time. So rather than challenge the alpha, you just wait until the alpha gets too old to maintain the position or gets sick.
Yeah.
Just one way or the other, the alpha realizes that his or her time has come to be the leader, and now you just step forward without any fighting or any mess or any fuss. And then the last category would be kind of a catch-all. You're a maverick. You just do whatever you want. And a prime example of that was one of the main characters in a previous book, Wolf 302, who never really seemed to want to be an alpha, but he sure knew how to treat the girl wolves well and had many descendants out there. And only when he was very, very, very late in life, almost by default, because there was no one else that wanted to be the alpha male, he finally became one. And despite his advanced years, actually, to our surprise, became a really good alpha male. So those are the things I've been interested in writing about lately.
Oh, neat. Well, we'll look forward to seeing Thinking Like a Wolf when it comes out. That'll be great. So I think we're out of time now, but I really appreciate talking with you. It's great to find out about. Yeah. Well, let's do it in a few. I've got a lot more questions to ask.
Okay.
let's do that again in a few weeks.
Okay. Thanks a lot. It was great fun.
Okay, thanks, Rick. Okay, our guest today has been Rick McIntyre, wolf researcher in Yellowstone National Park and author of The Alpha Female Wolf and the upcoming Thinking Like a Wolf. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com or kgvm.com and see additional features on our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.